The separation between science and human values is an illusion.
Where did we come from?
This is the first self-replicating species on the planet.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag Science Rising.
Hello and welcome to the Future Proof Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thanks very much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to listen to us today. We'll get to questions and comments later on in the podcast. Coming up on today's show, we're going to talk about the secrets of superhero science. If we wanted to have the powers of superheroes, what would we have to do? And ask whether or not science can actually do that for us. We'll also be addressing the dullest subject in the history of all subjects in science, big data. But I promise you, it will be very entertaining. The fabulous Tamandra Harkness has written a new book on it, and she'll be bringing us through one of these subjects that I haven't touched for, you know, we've been doing the program for 5 years, and I've just not gone anywhere near the semantic web or IoT, really, or big data, because it's just so hard to talk about in an interesting way. So, Tamandra, the challenge is set. First, as always, we'll look back at the week's science news, and joining me in studio are Drs. Lara Dungan and Shane Bergen. How are you both?
Good, thank you. How are
okay.
you, Jonathan? Good form this morning?
Yes, I am. Smart ass. I'm always on form when I'm on air.
Yeah, well, no, in fairness, you sounded an awful lot different as soon as it went live. little grumpy, though, are we? A little grumpy.
You're breaking the fourth wall, Lara.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
So, I suppose, because we've been talking about it so much off air, we should probably mention Brexit. And you wanted to make a point about Brexit from the scientific point of view, Shane.
Yeah, I think I was a scientist in the UK for 3 years, and I don't know any scientist in the UK that was pro-Brexit, because science works across borders and it relies on mobility of ideas and people. And for the UK now, that's gone, and it's an absolute disaster. They have committed academic suicide by taking this move. However, I'm sure we'll try and work something out. When you think four of the top 10 universities in the world are in the UK, and so the massive implications for both the EU and for Britain. But something that I was really worried about throughout this campaign was the role of experts, and the way that one of the Brexit side referred to experts all the time, dismissing them as being out of touch with the common man. And or a woman. And indeed, I thought that was really worrying. So it's like, you know, well, you're a learned person. You have considered this, but you're not really representing the ordinary man, as they kept saying. And this really, really worried me. And I see it all the time here in our own debates about various issues. And I think if we're going to start making more and more decisions democratically through referenda, then we need to start thinking about how do we make decisions in referenda individually. Because as I heard from many of my sociology colleagues, we don't make rational decisions when we vote. And that's either in elections or in referenda. And in order for us to actually practice democracy, we have to learn how to do that.
Well, I mean, it's we won't spend too much time on it because this is a science program, but it's like Nice. You know, it's such a complex question. It should never have been put in the hands of uneducated people like me, you know, like people who know what they're talking about should be making the decisions.
Well, perhaps it should, but it's just that we have to learn how to do that. And I think scientific thinking or scholarly thinking can be really useful about how we make informed decisions, as opposed to just going, you know, off the top of my head, I want to do this.
So that's Brexit.
There it is.
I've got it off my chest.
It's the first I've heard about Brexit, actually, in the last 24 hours. It's weird.
And all right.
Irish fans in France have been great cack as well, in case anyone wasn't on social media recently.
Is there a match on?
You're all caught up. All right, our first story.
Stop it. You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're acting like a child.
Look, they're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
He'll hear you.
Here he comes now. I'm getting out of here.
Johnny. Oh, no!
That is how we know zombies, that movie.
Is that Night of the Living Dead?
No, it is. Night of the Living Dead, 1968, George A. Romero's seminal classic. If you watch it now, it's a bit giggly, but at the time, it must have terrified people.
Oh, yeah.
And it's how we know what zombies are. And this first story is about zombie genes?
Yeah, this story, I just love this. I so often say this. This story has so many different elements. So this is a new thing. First of all, the first element I thought was really interesting is that it's published in a thing called a preprint server called BioOrXiv. I don't know if, Shane, if you've heard of this or anything. So it's not actually peer-reviewed yet. There seems to be this new. Maybe this isn't new. Maybe it's because I've been out of science too long. But they've published all of this and it actually hasn't been peer reviewed, which bothers me a little bit. But, you know, people know about it before the kind of year or two that it would take. So that's the first thing. So what they've done in this research group, they used to want to know. So this really interesting idea, I don't know if anyone watches CSI, but they go in and they find the body and they always go, oh, it's exactly 2 hours and 42 minutes since this body died. And when I was doing forensic and legal medicine, we did it just before Christmas as part of the medical degree. I felt like I was in an episode of CSI. Basically, the real way that they decide how long it is since the body died really is the last time you were seen alive or the last text or phone call you made. It's like, of course, there are biological ways and it's how warm they are, but really, they don't do it that way. And they need a better way to assess this. So not only have they found a better way to assess this, but they've also found, really interestingly, that when people or animals in this case die, certain genes are turned on, and they're turned on in a very specific sequence. So this can be used to tell if it's 24 hours since they died or 48 hours.
So when you die, genes are turned on.
Yeah, and so they're not sure why. They think it's maybe because when you die, certain genes are turned off because you die, but those genes were stopping other genes. And then that means it's kind of like a release mechanism in these other genes. So it's really interesting. It's a load of genes to do with inflammation. It's also genes to do with embryonic development, which I think is fascinating. Wow. Why on earth? But they think that maybe there's some way that the corpse is more like an embryo or something. And then the last thing, which I think is most interesting, is these are genes that also induce cancer. And what they find is people who get transplants from cadavers, like a cadaveric transplant rather than a live donor, they get much higher instances of cancer. So they're wondering now, is it because these genes are being switched on as soon as the original person dies?
Wow.
And they did all this in livers. So it's really fascinating stuff. But basically, what they found is a huge number. They looked at, it was 36,000 genes in zebrafish and 37,000 in mice. And they found about 500 in each that kind of have a specific sequence. And they're hoping to translate that into humans, not only to look at this kind of post-mortem interval, but also to look at all these other really just so many interesting things.
So like, how do you know when you're dead? Like, I know this sounds like a really simple question, but I just remember hearing something on the radio about when do you know when a strawberry is dead? And it was really hard to say. So, like,
I cannot tell you for a strawberry. Did they answer the strawberry question?
No, they didn't. There was loads of different opinions from different disciplines. But, like, you're trained to be a doctor. So how do you say when somebody's dead?
Well, there's two different types. There's brain dead and there's heart dead, essentially. So if your circulatory system has stopped and your brain is, or sorry, if your brain has stopped and your circulatory system is still going, then you are brain dead. So you are dead, even if your circulatory system is going. But then you can also say it's when the circulatory system stops. So there's two different ways, basically.
And they have a bunch of tests.
Really horrendous tests. I actually sat in on it once. It was fascinating, but they're really quite...
Very tough,
quite,
I'm sure.
Like emotionally kind of distressful, to be honest. But amazing stuff.
And so is what happens to your body when you die.
Oh,
And we did this interview on the programme a few years back, but if you can find it on iTunes, you should listen to the podcast. It's about a body farm that they have in America, where they basically they get dead bodies and they just leave them lying around in various places
and
to
see
how they decompose.
Oh, yeah, I remember this.
And it's just really horrific, like what happens. So they put some in the warm sun, they put some bodies in trunks and everything, and you can like walk around and see these dead bodies composing.
And you should find the link to that episode and put it up.
Yeah, I will. Okay, so our second story has to do with Venus.
Yeah, my favourite planet. So regular listeners will know I love the moon, but I really, really like Venus. And it's because it's Earth's twin, but yet it's very, very different to Earth. So a day on Venus lasts more than an Earth year in time. And so it's a really unusual place. And if we were to go there, as soon as you got into the atmosphere of Venus, you'd be flying through rain clouds of sulfuric acid. There'd be like metal rain as well. So crazy stuff, right?
What does metal rain look like? Is it like sort of soldering kind of iron sort of rain?
Yeah, I think so. So ions of metal rain. And so it's a very aggressive place. And if you were to die there, then forensics would be very, very interesting, because even the gases that are emitted from your dying corpse would be expelled by something called the electric wind that Venus has. And NASA have recently discovered this electric wind through using probes that they're able to use. And they have discovered that this electric wind may in fact be the reason that Venus doesn't have an ocean. So they think that once upon a time it did have an ocean, because there's an echo, there's a fingerprint there from something called deuterium, which we see in our oceans here
on
Earth.
Water.
Yeah, exactly. It's a type of hydrogen, exactly. And so They know that there was probably water there in the past, but they couldn't explain where it went and how did it go. They thought it was due to the solar wind, but in fact it may be due to something called the electric wind. They don't know how the electric wind actually manifests itself, but basically this wind, which is due to a potential difference, a voltage difference between different parts of its atmosphere, which is literally then pushing things called ions, which have electric charge, out into space. And so it expelled all of the necessary elements or molecules that would have been there for us to create water oceans.
Yeah, it's sort of reverse gravity in some ways, sort of pushing, you know, and they didn't realise it was so big, but they found it on Venus. It's extraordinarily powerful.
So we have one here on the Earth, but it's their one is five times more powerful, incredibly powerful. But interestingly, what they're saying is it may be due to the proximity of Venus to the Sun, and this has implications when looking at exoplanets. That's the 1,000 or so planets that we've discovered outside of our own solar system. If proximity to stars results in electric wind, and the electric wind then makes the planet uninhabitable, it's unlikely that planets that are closer to the Sun than the Earth is would have life.
Very interesting. Our third story has to do...
Always comes back to biology, doesn't it?
Biology.
Our third story has to do with night vision and how mammals evolved it. And this is this the theory or a proof?
Well, they've demonstrated, it's kind of, well, I mean, look, you can't prove evolution, can you? But they've demonstrated that they've actually found a specific protein. So there's two basic, well, there's actually three types of cells in the eye, but the kind of two mainly known ones are the rods and the cones. You say the rods and the cones. The rods and the cones. And the cones are for colour vision, so they're active in brighter light. And the...
rods, Lara.
The rods are for darker vision. So, In darker light, mammals are able to see an awful lot better than basically every other vertebrate. And they reckon this is because mammals kind of had no chance when dinosaurs were around. So what they started to do is they started to come out at night. And obviously, like evolution, if they could see better at night, then they survived better. And then they were the ones that bred. And what they did was they took zebrafish, which is a vertebrate, but it's down the fish origin. And they took mammals, and they looked at the evolution of these cells, and what they found was that there was a basic precursor cell that makes the rods and the cones. I don't know why I'm having such difficulty with that. The rods and the cones. And when they start to develop in the embryo, they all start to develop towards the rods, the cones. They start to develop towards the colour ones.
A fabulous job.
I'm so sorry.
Nailing
they start
it.
To develop towards the
There's
colour.
There's a quiz about this afterwards, by the way.
They start to develop towards the colour sensitive cells, the cones. And a protein basically swoops in called the NRL, and it stops them in mammals from developing that way. And it gives us a whole load of the kind of the darker, the rods in mammals, but it doesn't happen in vertebrates. So they reckon that this happened before we all kind of branched off from each other a long time ago, and then the mammals sort of developed this low light. And they think it's because there was much more predation in the daytime back in the Triassic period.
This night vision thing, like, we have a lot of these rods in our own eyes, don't we? But we don't use them. We can't see in the night as well as obviously many other animals can.
Yeah.
Is there any way of fixing that?
Well, so we have about 95% rods and about 5% cones.
So our almost all of our eye is devoted to night vision, but we can't see.
Yeah, but we can compared to a huge amount of other species. Like, we really can. I went to this cool cave when I was in New Zealand once, and when you walk in, you can't see anything. And there's a load of glowworms and stuff. And by the time you come back, you're in exactly the same type of light. You can see everything. You can see the hand in front.
Right,
so we actually
can
compared to a lot of species. But they're hoping they can use this to deal with kind of issues with sight and development and all these things. So that'd be quite cool.
Rod.
I don't know
has texted in. I'm not joking. A guy called Rod has texted in. What are the chances? He says, there are certainly no linguistic experts on your program. There is no such word as referenda in Latin.
I was wondering.
In Latin, the plural of referendum is referendum, as the word is a gerund or gerund.
I don't know. I've actually asked this to Professor of Latin in Trinity. She was not specific in her answer. So I don't know. I'll dispute Rod.
I'm sorry. We're not having any experts on this program, which is why I love having you on the show. Thanks for that, Rod. Referendum is the plural. I'll
referendum.
Take that.
Referendum.
And very quickly, our final story has to do with the science of what gives us a chill when we listen to music?
Yeah, so for I thought it was for everyone, but it's actually only for about half of us. So when we feel that tingle in the back of our neck when you hear an amazing piece of music, and it's all like in it's very personal what does it for you. There's actually a reason that that happens, a physiological reason, but there's a reason now that they can pin down linking our auditory cortex in our brain to the emotive centers in our brain. So there's literally a link between them. So the guys in Harvard, scientists in Harvard, they took 20 volunteers, half of which regularly got this response, half of which didn't. They put them into a fancy sort of MRI and they played music to them. And they looked at how the connections between different cortices of their brain, I hope that's the plural.
It is.
Thank you. They looked at how the links between different cortices lit up, and they could show that when people did feel that emotive response, then the connections between the auditory cortex and the emotional response centres of the brain lit up. Now, they don't that's, really
is
know...
Is not fairly obvious?
Nothing is obvious in science until you've measured it, right? And so this is the first time that they've actually done that. Sorry, I'm really uppity this morning. I apologise about that. It's your bad mood put me this way.
Grumpy and uppity. You're like the seven dwarves in here.
I'm in a fine mood.
So what they're trying to figure out now is if this is learned or if this is something we're born with. That's really interesting.
But they haven't like found a way of like play these particular notes and you make someone go get a chill down their spine.
No, they don't know why like I might like one type of music and you like another.
Okay, very good. Invisibility, bionic vision, bulletproof suits, superheroes seem to have all the fun. But what about you and me? What would it take for us to gain powers beyond human ability? Well, Barry Fitzgerald is a research scientist at Eindhoven University of Technology and the author of Secrets of Superhero Science. He joins me now. Hi, Barry, how are you?
Good afternoon, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm very good. Were you a big comic book superhero fan when you were younger?
I very much was, yeah. I was a huge superhero fan. I think the first time I can remember seeing one of the films was Superman from 1978. Now, I wasn't alive when that came out, but I saw it when I was about 5 or 6.
Yeah.
And I have to say, my priorities changed when I saw that film. I wanted to have superpowers.
Richard Donner, it's an absolute classic. Although I showed it to my 5-year-old when we were on holiday recently, and he was like, it's a bit slow moving, Dad. I was like, yeah, actually it is. All movies in the 70s were. Because some superhero movies, they've gone mad, haven't they, recently? There's so many of them, and they've sort of lost their specialness, I think.
I kind of agree and I disagree with a little bit what you've said there. In a way, yes, there are plenty of them out there at the moment. And in fact, 4 of those films are now in the top 12 grossing films of all time.
Mm.
So Captain America Civil War, I think, now is number 12.
Really?
Closing in on Minions, yeah. It's made, what, $1.15 billion?
I'm not sold on Captain America, maybe because it's real nationalistic sort of stuff, but it's not really my sort of cup of tea. But I did see Deadpool, which is awesome.
Deadpool is a great film.
Yeah, but it's not a kid's movie. Anyway,
let's get to the science
then.
The films that I was just going to say is that they don't really just do the good and the bad guy anymore. It's more political thrillers and psychological thrillers.
Yeah.
And there's worldwide implications. I mean, it's not just some kid at school who's got some superpowers and he doesn't know what he's going to do with them.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. There's more social commentary in sometimes it's subtle and sometimes it's not that subtle.
Precisely.
Which is kind of like what the comic books are actually about. So, let's start off with the obvious one, which when we think about science, X-Men, because X-Men, I believe, Stanley created... to basically, because he didn't want to have to keep on coming up with origin stories, so he came up with this idea that their DNA is mutated and that's how they've got all these powers. How likely is it that in the future we'd be able to change someone's genes to give them something like wings or stronger, more strength or that sort of thing? Because those sort of genes do exist in other animals. Can we copy and paste?
It seems like there actually is an answer to this. The technique has just been, we'll say it's very recent. It's called the CRISPR-Cas genetic editing tool.
Mm.
And the key behind this particular tool is that it effectively, the best way to describe it, is that it chops up your DNA. And it gives you the option to either destroy particular genes or you can insert brand new genes in the place of a particular piece of code that you've edited. So, for example, if we could identify, let's say, for example, the genes associated with the proteins for, well, my personal favorite is Wolverine's accelerated healing power.
Yeah.
And if we could identify those,
like in a salamander, where they can grow their limbs back,
I would say in terms of any illness is what I'm kind of referring to here.
Because
with Wolverine, I mean, he can regenerate, of course, but he also recovers almost instantaneously. In a way, yes, I do agree with you that it's somewhere related to the salamander. But imagine being able, if we were able to do that, and just simply say, take our genetic code and insert these at the correct location so that they're expressed in the correct way and produce the proteins when necessary to give us this accelerated healing power.
But I wanted to ask you, like, how realistic is that? I mean, have people tried to do that so far? I mean, has anyone tried to put wings on a mouse transfer the genes that are associated with regenerative cells into something like a rat?
As far as I know, the main research for this particular approach has been towards destroying genes, so preventing them from being expressed. So any genetic code that is associated with a genetic disease, be that a blood disorder, or for example, even going as far as some variants of cancer. The idea with this kind of technology is that it could be used to edit a genetic code in an embryo, for example, or pre-embryo, so that the next generation doesn't necessarily generate or develop these particular ailments. So there was a group in China, and this was out last year, I believe, in Nature, and this was led to quite a lot of controversy, because what they actually did was they looked at the genetic editing of non-viable embryos. And they were able to, with quite good success, use this CRISPR-Cas system to destroy the genes associated with this particular blood disorder.
Wow. And by the way, if people are wondering why I'm suggesting that scientists put wings on a mouse, I'm not saying like that's a good idea or promoting it. It's just you'd be surprised what scientists will do given the time and the resources. It's what about Iron Man then? Because Iron Man has this awesome suit, and I when I watch it, I kind of go, realistically, okay, obviously if you have some sort of nuclear core, you've got a lot of power there, but how realistic is it that you'd be able to build a suit that can do what Iron Man can do?
Well, I suppose the thing we should look at our own present day is that we live in a world where wearable technologies is really commonplace. I think everybody wears technology at some point during the day, be it a GPS watch or a smartphone or a smart device. And the Iron Man suit is the ultimate wearable technology. I mean, it is, when you think about everything that it can do, it's an onboard computer, it's a telephone. It also has the fundamental aspects of an airplane. It takes off, it flies, and it lands. And you wear it instead of getting into it. Now, we have, if you take the Iron Man suit and take all of the things that it actually do, we can do all of those independently from each other. We have phones, we have supercomputers, we have advanced jetpacks, for example, people have actually developed that can give you maneuverability similar to an Iron Man suit. So all we got to do is put it all together and put it into a suit.
Well, power is the problem, though, right? I mean, a huge amount of power, and obviously it would be quite dangerous, you would imagine, to be close to that amount of power and wearing it on you.
I completely agree, yes. And of course, as everybody knows, that if you're using your smartphone or if you have your laptop on your lap, for example, when you're doing some work, you'll notice that it can get quite hot and quite uncomfortable. So imagine Tony Stark inside in this Iron Man suit. Now, I believe fundamentally that's one of the key things he would have to address is how does he solve the issue with all of this waste heat that's been produced within the suit. Now, the option there to do so is the use of thermoelectric materials, which are materials that convert waste heat, waste thermal energy, into electricity. And the same materials have been used by NASA, for example, on the Mars rovers to generate electrical power by converting the thermal energy generated during the nuclear decay of plutonium isotopes into electrical energy. So, in fact, Iron Man, I think that will be a good first choice, not only to exploit thermoelectrics, but also to recycle all of the waste energy that he generates in the suit. Anytime he fires the rocket propulsion system, anytime he fires a weapon, anytime he uses his computer, it could be 100% reusable device that does not actually require any external charging, for example, like you have for an electric car, or the idea of having to load up on traditional gasoline.
What about Spider-Man and his spider silk, this really, really strong spider silk that he, spits out of his wrists, it seems. Is there anything like that in real life?
Well, there is actually. So of course, spider silk is actually one of the toughest natural materials on the planet. And many people thought, well, wouldn't it be really interesting if we could mass produce this material, for example, to be used in an alternative bulletproof technology. And about 14, 15 years ago, a company in the United States actually did this. Now, in order to do that, they needed to come up with a way of actually mass producing it, because you're not going to set a factory up with 1 million spiders and then extract spider silk from all of those. It's going to be far too time consuming, and you're not going to find enough people who are actually going to be willing to do that.
And another one of the problems is that the best spiders for producing this sort of silk tend to attack and kill each other a lot. So I think they actually did try to make spider silk from a bunch of spiders, and they just ended up eating each other. So
that's also an issue they have to contend with. So why don't we turn to a species that doesn't eat itself, let's say, or that risk isn't there. So the concept they used was a few years back was to combine the genetic code of a goat with the genetic code of a spider. And they were able to generate produce spider silk within the goat's milk when the goat was milked. So in terms of a business model, they've got it down with their first product. They got goat's milk going out one door and they got spider silk going out the other.
So, what do you mean going out? Like one udder gives them milk and the other udder gives them spider silk?
It was soluble spider silk produced in the milk. So then they would extract the spider silk from the milk.
Right.
And, of course, you can then, if you wish, sell that milk as spider goat milk. And then you have your spider silk, which is then produced. And because you're using, an animal that's obviously exceptionally larger than a spider, you can mass produce it. And this particular company that was involved in this actually had herds of these spider goats on farms, spider goat farms, if you will.
How do the goats feel about that?
I'm not sure they were probably...
I mean, you'd be freaked out a bit, wouldn't you? You know, if spider silk started coming out of your breasts.
Yeah, I suppose many people would. I mean, and if you think about it, actually, anatomically speaking, so the Spider-Man is depicted as having shooting it out of his wrists, but a spider, anatomically speaking, produces silk from spinnerets in its abdomen, so really... If it was to be actually correct, the comic book writer should have had Peter Parker producing spider silk from his nipples, actually. But of course...
That would have made a very different comic book movie, I think.
There you go. That's right. So they make it a bit more practical, have it coming out of his wrists.
Barry Fitzgerald is a research scientist at Eindhoven University of Technology, author of Secrets of Superhero Science. There's a lot more fun and interesting science in it. Thanks very much for joining us, Barry.
No problem. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Now, we are creating a stupid amount of data, like insane. A few years ago, one of the statistics I heard was that it is more than a stack of DVDs from here to the moon and the back again every day. That's what we're creating. That statistic is 3 years old. Nobody knows how much we're creating right now, but a lot of that information has gotten really personal. They know a lot about what you and I do in private. So what are they doing with this information? Tamandra Harkness is a presenter, comedian and author of Big Data, Does Size Matter? She joins me now. Hi,
Hi.
Tamandra.
Hiya, how are you doing?
We're creating all this data, this information. I think people are aware of that. But is there a moment in history that the first bit of information was recorded? I'm not talking about, like, you know, words or pictures, but the first time something was encoded into a zero or a one.
Well, I put it to, I don't know, 0-1. I put it back to about 30,000 years ago in the Ice Age. Somebody kept a tally on what was a wolf bone in a cave in Central Europe, and they just tallied like groups of five like you might today. And it seems
Hang
now,
on,
you look
30,000 years ago, they were counting
30,
in fives.
Yeah, 30,000 years ago. Well, you would count in fives because you've got five fingers. So they're marking things off in fives the same way I did when I was writing the book. I kept a tally of cups of tea.
Was this the amount of women that they dragged into the cave, or what were they notching on their
wolf
bone?
That would have been pretty good, because I think it was 57 notches. Well, that's the thing. That's the weird thing. We don't know what they were counting. You know, I like to think maybe they were counting wolves, and there was an argument over who killed more wolves.
Right.
And they got sick of having the skulls piling up in the cave and went, you can't just keep piling up your wolf skulls here. It's taking up loads of room and the dogs keep eating them. Find some better way to keep a record. And so someone went, oh, I know, I'll scratch on here. And then, but we don't know. That's the thing. We don't know who it was. We don't know if it was the same person. And it seems a small thing now. But if you look back, I think the difference between collecting a pile of stuff and just keeping these marks, and then you could compare them with somebody else's bone with marks on, that's the kind of, I put that as the first moment of digital data, because digital is really just numbers you can count on your fingers. So if you've got groups of five, that's digital in a very broad definition.
It's a good story. So the zeros and ones thing, because I don't want to insult people's intelligence, but all of the information that we have on the internet is essentially broken down to a switch on, off, zeros and ones. That is binary, essentially. When did that come about, and when did we start doing that sort of thing?
Well, that was when we started doing things with computers, really. So that would have been early 20th century, because that was when it became electrical. But actually, back in the 19th century, they were using punch cards for things. They used punch cards to keep records of the census data in America. And before that, Jacquard, who invented the loom, used punch cards to... Well, he didn't invent the loom. He invented the Jacquard loom system. And he used punch cards to... put the patterns into the loom, so you could do pictures by encoding them onto punch cards, which basically said to the loom, push the warp thread down or don't push it down. So that was binary.
When was
in
that
effect. That was the 18th century, I think.
Good
I
lord
to, I know I should know this because it's in my book. Do you want me to look it up?
You did write this book, to imagine, did you?
It's a very long book. There's 296 pages in it. I can't remember all of them now.
If only there's some way you could search through it in your mind.
Touché.
So I wanted to talk a bit about all this information, because we're stacky. Do you have a good figure on how much we're making at the moment?
Do you know, I gave up, because every time I looked it up, it had changed.
Yeah.
And I thought, because obviously, books being books, I wrote it, finished it at the end of last year. And I thought, by the time this is in print, it'll be out of date. I mean, you use the thing of the DVDs to the moon and back.
Yeah.
And I love that's the kind of standard international scientific unit for really big things. How many times did it go to the moon and back? But actually, you think you don't put data on a DVD anymore because it's too small. If why we don't put programs on CDs in our computers anymore, because it's not big enough. You download it from the cloud. I think it's doubling every 3 years by some estimates.
Which
it's
is
just
extraordinary,
getting bigger
isn't it?
And bigger and bigger. There's a lovely story. I spoke to a brain scientist in America who now uses very detailed brain scan data, and then he compares it with genetic data, and so he can study people's diseases from lots of different dimensions, which is a really great thing. And he said when he first graduated, his first postdoc research post, they sent him out to buy the biggest hard drive they could afford to store all the data from their scans, and he brought it back and it was 4 gigabytes. And people would come into the studio and look at it, because it was the biggest one they'd ever seen. And, you know, I imagine half the listeners are going, well, I've got that in my phone. I've got that in my MP3 player.
Yeah.
But, and that was, well, he doesn't look very old on his photo, I'll say it that way. So it wasn't that long ago.
No,
and
it,
now
it,
it's
it,
like
it,
petabytes.
Yeah. And China have
bigger.
just have announced and unveiled their latest supercomputer, which it's actually, there's no point. It's beyond human comprehension how fast it is. There's no point in sort of wasting our time talking about it. So you talked about medicine. What can big data do for good before we start to talk about the bad and the spooky?
Oh, it can do all sorts of things. I mean, I think in scientific research, it's completely changed the game.
But why is that? Because, I mean, like, we've always been gathering data. Why is big data suddenly this term that everyone's been throwing around? Is it just the exponential growth? And is it because the numbers are so big, it just gives us such a better insight? Or what is it?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, you know, I kind of subtitled the book, Does Size Matter? Mainly to give people a heads up, there will be puns in it. But but the answer to that really is yes, but it also matters what you do with it. So there are some things where just by having lots and lots of information, you can get answers that you couldn't have got. And the Large Hadron Collider is an example of that. They'd never have found the Higgs boson without being able to collect stupendous, ridiculous amounts of data, so much that they have to throw most of it out within seconds because there's not even room to store it.
Really?
And that's just partly because they had... I mean, obviously, it's also terribly clever theoretical physics, but it is partly just that they were able to collect all this data and then process it.
But it's
also other things like we can now compare very different types of data. So the brain scientist I mentioned, he was looking at brain scans, which are very detailed pictures of an individual's brain, and also their genetic records. So you could see, you know, is there a link between their genetics and brain disorders that they have? And then I spoke to another brain scientist who said, oh, well, what I like to do is find out people's postcodes and look at the weather records and see whether the amount of sunlight they were exposed to, or even the pollution they're exposed to, whether that had an effect on the progress of their disease. So it's that ability to take really different types of data and plug them together.
Is that
much fuller picture.
Is that risky, though, when you know, when you get a huge amount of information, you see sort of patterns that people might draw, you know, causality out of them when they're just coincidences? Like, you know, if you got all of the people in London and checked to see, you know, what jeans they were wearing, whether or not they had a PhD, you might find that some people who had a certain brand or waist size were more likely to have a PhD. It doesn't necessarily mean that buying those jeans is going to give you a doctorate. So, is there a worry with big data, or when it's so big, does it not matter what the relationship is? If there's a relationship, it's useful enough information.
I think it does matter. And I think you've put your finger on it, that especially when these techniques started coming out, people started saying, oh, you know, it no longer matters what causes things, because if we can find the pattern, then we can change things just by tweaking the pattern. And I think there's a lot of risks associated with that. Some of it just that you end up with something that's wrong. I mean, I went back and found a very old example of this when cholera was hitting London in the 19th century. Somebody who, it's actually William Farr, who did a lot of really good work with finding causes of death and public health. And there's a research institute named after him in Scotland. But he wanted to find out what caused cholera. And the most popular theory at the time was miasma, was bad smells, basically, coming up from the river. And the river was really stinky because everyone just tipped their sewage into it. And he found these records of how many people had died of cholera, and he looked at how far above the river they lived, so literally how many feet higher than the river they were. And he found a really good correlation between the closer you lived to the river in height, the more likely you were to die of cholera. So he went, well, you know, this proves it. I could draw you a little graph that shows you that people who live low down near the river are very likely to die. People who live high up, very unlikely to die. And that seemed to back up the most popular theory of the time. But actually, if you go back and look at the same data and say, well, let's instead break this down by where did you get your drinking water from? It's really clear that if you got your drinking water from upstream of where all the sewage went into the, apologies if anyone's eaten their lunch, by the way, then you were much less likely to die. If you lived downstream.
That would have been a fairly obvious one,
well,
I would have thought. That's, you know, but there
that's
you go.
The thing, hindsight is a wonderful thing. You know, with hindsight, well, like, you go, drinking, how could people not know that smoking's bad for you? But at the time when lung cancer showed this massive sudden increase, there were all sorts of new things. There were like asphalt roads, people had come back from the war after being gassed. You know, it wasn't obvious until somebody found it.
So we need insight and analysis to do something with this sort of data. And you talked about medicine, but there's other things that can be done with big data. And it's some of it's quite controversial. The idea that you can use a lot of information to predict crime and the likelihood of someone reoffending and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you see, this is where, for me, it becomes very problematic, because the more you involve human beings, the more, on the one hand, there's a danger that you confuse population with individuals. So you can look at a whole population and say, oh, look, how interesting. Every year, on average, this number of people will die by being hit by a tram, for example. Very few, I imagine. But if you then point at each individual and say, you've got a 5% chance of being hit by a tram, it's not that, it's much less than that, then you're kind of going, it's actually impossible to say about an individual with any level of certainty. And then if you come onto things that are actually actions that people do, like committing a crime, then you're essentially saying, oh, because 10% of the people in your postcode will at some point commit a crime, then you've got a 1 in 10 chance of offending, and therefore you're like a tenth of a criminal, in effect. So you're prejudging people. I mean, that's what prejudice, literally prejudging. You're, instead of saying you're innocent until we prove you guilty of something, you're kind of saying you're at risk of committing a crime, and therefore you're effectively already part criminal. And that's where I think you really need to be careful about But the difference between saying, oh, well, maybe there's something going on in this part of town, leading to more crime, and actually pointing to a person and saying, your destiny is to be a criminal.
But that said, are those patterns not useful? I mean, if you looked at the type of person that, you know, if you had enough data points about someone, to be sort of very egalitarian and say, you know what, let's just trust that no one will reoffend. Is that not a bit foolish if you have data to say the likelihood of this person offending versus another is much higher? You know, by treating everyone as an individual, you're sort of abdicating any sort of ability to stop future crime.
Well, I mean, that's the problem, I think, because obviously most of us would agree that it's better to prevent crime than to punish people for it. But I think there's a couple of difficulties. One is that we assume that because something's being done by a machine, by an algorithm, that you feed lots of data in, therefore it must be objective. And in fact, it isn't objective, because even if you say to the machine, you mustn't take any account of somebody's race, for example, then other factors come up. And we're back to our kind of correlation thing, that there are algorithms they use in America for exactly that, to predict who's at high risk of reoffending.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. No, they're in widespread use in America.
So they use computers.
Yeah.
But what do they do? Do they make decisions based on them?
No, they make recommendations. They give people risk levels. So they say this person is at 67% chance of reoffending.
Based on a computer assessing
various things. And there's a number of problems with this. One of them is, as I say, the natural justice thing, that suddenly you're not looking at an individual and saying, I as a judge, what am I prepared to assess is the chance that this person will be reformed or will reoffend, and I'm going to use my human judgment. But even if you say, actually, it's useful to have this kind of background information, the algorithm they use belongs to a private company, and the private company won't tell anyone what the factors are that go in.
Really?
And not only that, but some journalists from ProPublica in America did a very good piece of investigation and found that the algorithm is not unbiased. We don't know what it's using. It's probably not directly using race. It's probably using things like postcode or parents' occupation, or we don't know. But it's, if you're black, it's 2 or 3 times as likely to wrongly predict that you'll reoffend.
Oh dear.
And if you're white, it's more likely to wrongly predict that you won't reoffend.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
But we think, because it's a computer, right, it must be objective, it must be fair. We have that thing of, we don't really trust humans. Humans are a bit biased. Humans are probably a bit racist. Surely a computer is better.
Yeah.
But it
depends on the data, on the parameters set by the human.
Tell
me about your thoughts on privacy then, because, you know, I started off by saying that, you know, the internet knows so much about us, and these companies are constantly taking our permission to share information, to learn a huge amount of information from us. Do you think it matters if this idea of privacy, do you think it matters?
I think it matters very much. Not because I'm incredibly paranoid and I think everybody who uses my information is evil.
What have you done, Tamandra?
Well, you know, they always say this thing of, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. And I always say, yeah, if you've got nothing to hide, you haven't really lived. Everybody should have something to hide from somebody. But I think it is a trade-off. People say, well, you know, you trade off benefits by giving up your data and your privacy. Yeah. I think one of the problems is that we're not usually explicitly asked. And I think companies are starting to realise that it's better for them to explicitly come to us and say, we'd like to collect this data about you and use it for this. Is that okay? And in return for that, they get better quality information and we're happy and we don't feel so used. There are definitely benefits. I mean, health data is an example. It's really thorny because it's incredibly personal.
Yeah.
If someone had access to my health records, you know a lot about somebody's personal life. It could be misused in the wrong hands. And also, because of this correlation thing, when people try and do research and say, what's causing obesity, for example, you might look at health records and put it with a load of other records and say, we can see what's happening here. What we need to do is get all these people to change what they're doing, which might be fine if they come out explicitly and say, look, this is our recommendation. But if it's going to result in I don't know, for example, people being denied operations because their store card said they bought pizza every week for 10 years. Then, you know, is that fair? Is that good
news?
Yeah.
So it's a big question as to whether or not, you know, it's a good idea to give all the people all of the information, isn't there?
Yeah. I think the important thing is that we actually think privacy is important, and having control over who knows what and what they do with it is important, and we should protect that. But at the same time, there is enormous value to sharing data. I mean, the medical research possibilities of sharing health records are fantastic.
Absolutely,
and enormous.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the more information we get on the genome, and the more we can mix all this stuff together, we get huge potential.
Exactly,
and
we could all benefit. And also it's an altruistic thing. Maybe somebody else would benefit.
Yeah.
So I think it's important, really, that we have a good relationship of trust with whoever's using the data, so that we trust them to make good use of it, and they trust us to tell us the truth with what they find, maybe come back and say, good news, pizza is actually good for you.
Well, here's hoping. Tamandra Harkness, presenter, comedian, and author of Big Data Does Size Matter, thanks very much for joining us. So if you have any thoughts or questions, complaints about what you've heard, you can contact us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. You can also email us, science@newstalk.com. We were off last week due to coverage of the Belgium match. I was actually in Bordeaux. And if you think of the three matches that Ireland played in this year's European football finals, you've got to say Belgium was probably not the one to be there for. It was chaos. If you've ever been to an Irish football game, this sort of cliche about the Irish fans being the best in the world, you imagine the Belgians probably think they're the best fans in the world. And in fairness, during the game, they were phenomenal. But it was really, really lovely to see how Irish people behaved after the defeat, a crushing defeat by Belgium. It was just fantastic. And Paul from Carlo, who entertained probably the whole of Bordeaux that weekend, if you're listening, serious props to you. It was a very friendly fella from Carlo, chatting up every girl he could possibly see, getting rides in convertibles. Everywhere I turned, he was there. So Paul, hat tip. So last week, Time Cheltenham Science Festival, which is such a lovely event because you just get to sit down and talk to really, really smart people about what it is that they do. And it's a lovely weekend for me and obviously for the FameLab contestants. An amazing experience. FameLab is the science communication competition that is now global. Over 30 countries take part. And Niamh Kavanagh from Ireland was representing us. It's a competition put on by the British Council to encourage scientists to think about how to communicate their science. And it's a really, really fantastic competition. If you're into science, check out famelab.org or thebritishcouncil.ie. So we also during that episode heard from guests like Adam Hart, who was talking about groups of animals and the social lives of animals, which was fascinating. We spoke to comedian Robin Ince about the brains of comedians, and we spoke to Dr. Tamsin Edwards about climate change. Tom says the communication or emergent coordination of these bugs and insects is one of the most fascinating realities in the natural world. Such complexity and intricate design in organising a fully functioning and efficient working system or social order. I totally agree, Tom. You know, like if you would say, oh, let's talk about insects, most people might go, oh, really? But actually, the way they organize themselves with such apparent little intelligence is unbelievable. Susan says, interesting chat about the communication and realities of climate science. Very concerning to think that we could have a US president who doesn't accept the facts, Susan. Interesting choice of words there, Susan. I don't know if you know, but you wrote that we could have a US president. And there's sort of that feeling that Trump will be for us all. It's, you know, whatever Trump, if Trump gets in, the Trump effect will affect the entire globe. And add to that the potential idea that Boris Johnson, who's also been sceptical about climate change, may be leading Britain. I mean, it's going to be a very interesting year, that's for sure. Listen, thanks everyone for getting in contact on Twitter. At Newstalk Science is our address. Email address is science@newstalk.com. You can check out previous podcasts on iTunes.com or newstalk.com in the podcast section. Click subscribe if you can through your player. Really appreciate it. And thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was researching, Stephen Jordan, who was producing. We will speak to you next time. You can catch the show live, though, every Saturday from 12 Irish time. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. #ScienceRising.